Coming up on Weekend America.
In Detroit, healthcare, the economy, and crime are not separate issues.
And she got rushed to the hospital. And by the time I got over there, it was already too late. They pushed the air conditioner out, ransacked the place.
This weekend, a court shows the city's struggles. I'm John Moe. Of course, cities have beauty, too. All you need to do is look down.
I thought it was like people were finding out when the sidewalks were being replaced and then sneaking in the middle of the night and doing this. But now you're saying they're on the city payroll. It's a little less romantic now, but still very cool.
A sidewalk looks like a blank piece of paper. Why not write some poetry on it? Also this hour, America's top dobro player talks about his influences.
So I was hearing the Beatles and the Stones at night, hearing Flatten Scruggs in the morning. So I was a little confused musically. But so I ended up adapting a lot of that into my own playing.
You'll also find out what a dobro is on Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. Another tough week in financial news, just like the last few weeks. A crisis on Wall Street, wrangling on Capitol Hill. People are talking about all of that this weekend. But that's not all they're talking about. We take to the streets this hour, reading poetry on sidewalks and memorials on cobblestones. We'll also meet the king of the dobro and learn about that instrument's journey. Built in Czechoslovakia, it became a favorite of American bluegrass fans. And education aside, you'll just want to hear the dobro played. It's really cool. What are you doing this weekend?
Well, this weekend, we're going down to the Alabama-Kentucky game.
And then on Sunday, we're going to the race in Talladega.
I'm
going to
go eat lunch in Omaha.
I'll probably do some fishing.
This weekend, I'm helping my parents move. They are actually in their 50s, and they have finally built their dream home.
This weekend, I'm actually racing in the Hueytown 10K.
This weekend, I believe I'm going to a party where someone is going to turn their thermostat down to about 50 degrees, and we're all going to wear winter clothes. It's a winter in the fall party.
I just got sad all of a sudden. Winter already? Those voices came from Phoenix, Lincoln, Nebraska, and Birmingham, Alabama. Well, as you may know by now, the president has signed the bailout bill that Congress sent him on Friday. Let's hope that it eases some economic anxiety, given the stock market drama all week, up and down, but mostly down. It'll be weeks or months, maybe years, before we fully understand what's gone on in this credit crisis and what the implications are. But we do know it's not just a Wall Street and Capitol Hill story. Marketplace's New York bureau chief, Amy Scott, left her perch over the center of the financial universe this week to hit the road and ask people across the country what's going on for them in the middle of this mess. Amy and Marketplace Money's Tess Vigeland will meet up in St. Louis, due there next weekend. Amy, what has the financial crisis meant to the people you're talking to?
Well, John, I started in Charlotte, which is the country's second largest banking center and where one of the city's biggest employers, Wachovia, is about to be bought either by Citigroup or now maybe Wells Fargo, which just entered the mix. So people are feeling it there. The bank employs about 20,000 people in Charlotte, so people are naturally very worried about layoffs. I talked to a barber who's been cutting bankers' hair for more than 30 years. He says roughly half of his business is from Wachovia employees, and that gives you a real sense of how layoffs could really ripple throughout the whole economy in Charlotte.
And what are people saying about the bailout?
Well, I would say I'm hearing one of two things from most people I talk to, anger or resignation. I went to a high school volleyball game the other night in Charleston, West Virginia, and I met Ted Young, who drives a school bus for the local school district, and he had no sympathy for the people and the banks that got in over their heads.
If it's me having a problem and I don't spend my money right, I'm the one that hurts. These people, they messed up, and they know they did, and they should take the bite. They should go down. Don't bother me at all. As for Wall Street, it will come back.
But I'm also hearing from a lot of people that while they don't like this rescue package, they feel that Congress had to do something. One thing I found in West Virginia is that many people feel a bit removed from this financial crisis. I mean, for one thing, the economy wasn't in great shape to begin with, and the real estate market never really heated up like it did in other parts of the country, so they haven't seen the same levels of foreclosures. So I think some people are wondering how much of a crisis this really is.
So as you've left the hallowed halls of Wall Street, what's been surprising to you?
Well, one thing that's surprising is that a lot of people I've met tell me they aren't looking at their 401ks and retirement accounts right now. To me, that just takes a great fortitude at a time like this. But another thing Tess and I are on the lookout for as we make our way across the country is some positive stories. For example, I met a woman in Charlotte, Carmela Johnson, who's the assistant manager of an apartment complex.
You know, with all the foreclosures in the city, a lot of people are losing their homes, so they have to have a place to stay. And we're thankful that we have an apartment complex that's available. And as of Friday, we became 100% occupied. So there's always going to be a need, a demand and a need, and our need has been met.
So frankly, it's been really refreshing to hear from people who have something happy to say.
And where else are you off to this weekend, Amy?
Well, today I'm going to explore Pittsburgh a bit. I just arrived here last night, and the city is celebrating its 250th birthday today with all kinds of historical reenactments and music and fireworks. So I'll probably check out some of that and talk to folks about how they're feeling about the economy. And then everyone keeps telling me to go to this legendary sandwich place here where they put french fries and coleslaw right on the sandwich.
Yes, I've heard of this.
But I'm a little skeptical.
Marketplace New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you, John.
Well, look at any poll of voters this weekend, and you'll see that, yes, the economy is the number one issue on their minds, miles ahead of all the other issues that generally get talked about in an election year, things like the war or healthcare, the environment, or crime. Of course, crime still does matter, and it's still on people's minds. We wanted to get a look at the issue of crime from the point of view of those who deal with it all day long. So Weekend America's Desiree Cooper headed over to the 36th District Court in Detroit. If you're in jail over the weekend in Detroit, a judge there will probably be the one to decide whether or not you get bail. Des found that folks in weekend court are thinking a lot about the economy and maybe just as urgently as on Wall Street.
Every 6 weeks, this is how Charles Anderson spends his weekend.
You're to have no contact with a complaining witness. Do you understand what I mean by no contact?
For 11 years, he's been a magistrate at Detroit's 36th District Court. All of the judges on the court take turns doing weekend arraignments, reading defendants their rights, explaining charges to them, setting bail, and sometimes giving lectures.
No text messaging, no smoke signals from a fire. You got what I mean?
On this Saturday, it's the usual, a domestic violence case. The defendant's not actually here in court. To spare the expense of transporting prisoners, they do video arraignments. The clerk phones the precincts around the city, and the prisoners and the magistrate see each other through a monitor. Anderson's courtroom is on the first floor. The video defendants can't see the chalkboard in the corner. It says, "There are no elevators to success, only stairs." Anderson has a slight build, and he wears wire-framed glasses. Beneath this robe, he's wearing shorts. After weekend court, he's going to an art fair. Before court gets started, Anderson has to sign arrest warrants. More and more of those are coming in for theft, and it's gotten worse since Michigan's unemployment rate is headed toward double digits. Aluminum siding and copper plumbing have been disappearing all over the city. As he stamped his paperwork, Anderson said that people were even snatching engine parts for traces of precious metals.
Now, I haven't seen anybody come through specifically arrested for taking a catalytic converter. But again, they are like so fast. It's like that Nicolas Cage movie, Gone in 60 Seconds or Less.
This is case number 08654. The defendant is charged with count.
The arraignments start at noon. The proceeding is cold and impersonal, like ATM justice. There's an audio delay that makes the conversation awkward, and the defendants lean toward the monitor because they're having a hard time hearing. The television images are dark and really unfocused, and that makes all of them seem a little bit shady. Many are about 20-ish, and they look scared.
Can we say the charges are maximum penalties since they were just read?
Yes, sir.
You still working at VIP Oil Change?
Yes, sir.
You've been there for 6 years?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm going to set your bond at $10,000.
Anderson is concerned about the defendant keeping his job a tether to life on the straight and narrow.
You got what I mean?
Yes, sir.
Because you will be arrested and you'll lose that nice job of yours. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
Alvis Owen is a court liaison from the Detroit Police Department, and he understands why the magistrate is worried.
There are no jobs. So you see a lot of young people, when you would be going out working, they're actually doing other things. You see a lot of young carjackers. You know, it just seems that they go from juvenile right into adulthood committing their first crime.
The other police liaison is Robert Mingus. He's the great-grandnephew of jazz legend Charles Mingus. Now, Robert's not musical, but he is artistic. During the arraignments, he does these 30-second doodles, caricatures of the court clerk and my engineer, the big heads and the tiny bodies. When he's off duty, Mingus runs a program to get men to be responsible fathers. In court, the doodling helps keep his mind off of how young the defendants are. Mingus says it's not just unemployment that's feeding crime. It's also foreclosures.
We think we're one of the top people in maybe in foreclosures. I think Las Vegas and Florida is right up there. A lot of people just walking away from houses, nothing they can do.
The empty houses, he said, are creating more opportunity for crime, and it's even touched his family.
My grandmother's 81, and she's taking care of my great-grandma, who's 99. And they've been there for, 60-something years. And she got rushed to the hospital, and she left out at like 11 o'clock. And by the time I got over there, it was already too late. They pushed the air conditioner out, and then they ransacked the place. And, it's just sad that something like that, I mean, these people don't do nothing to anyone,
Both defendants are charged with count one, malicious destruction of personal property.
As the magistrate rolls through the Saturday docket, a surprise case comes across the bench. On the monitor, two young guys stand against the wall looking sheepish.
6 months. Both defendants are present for arraignment.
The allegations state that you were engaged in removing the catalytic converter from the complainant's vehicle.
Evidently, those guys weren't gone in 60 seconds. It's nearly 1 p.m., and things are drawing to a close. In an hour, they've arraigned about a dozen defendants. And through the week and into next weekend, it'll be more of the same. For Officer Owen, it's part of a much larger problem.
We, for some reason, have kind of lost focus on us. Everything is shipped out. We're consumers instead of producers. That's the one thing I would like to see change. And that would put people back to work if we produce the things that we use.
And that would make his job a lot easier. In Detroit, I'm Desiree Cooper for Weekend America.
Check out Weekend Court and Officer Mingus's doodles at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
If someone stole your computer, your hard drives, all the pictures and memories stored therein, what would you say to that person? Ahead on Weekend America.
Thank you.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Today is October 4th, or as you're likely to write it down, 10-4. It's a big day in my house. When my wife was in college, she and her friends had this big party on 10-4, trucker-themed, CB radios, 10-4, get it? They dressed as truckers, or at least how college students thought truckers dressed, served truck stop food, everyone got a CB handle, gave out candy amphetamines. So every year when October 4th comes around, we wish each other a happy 10-4, a little holiday. Lately, I've been thinking about CB radios. You know,
CB radios? I'm a child of the 70s, where for a few years there, citizen band radios were suddenly huge. CBs had been around for a while, popular among truckers, but in the 70s they became cheap, more people could get them, and America fell in love with CBs and truckers. It went cultural with this.
Big Ben, this here's a rubber duck, and I'm about to put the hammer down.
Cause we are little guys.
CBs were rebellious. They had jargon. There was the whole avoiding the cops thing, like in Smokey and the Bandit. Burt Reynolds in a Trans Am. Give it up for Burt. Of course, it must have bugged the truckers that every kid I knew could get on a CB radio and just act like idiots. Man, it was fun. I wouldn't always talk either. I remember listening to my dad's CB and knowing those trucks were out there, hearing the lonely drivers talk to each other. Made me feel less lonely somehow. The fad died out. There are plenty of CB enthusiasts today, but America stopped wanting to act like truckers. Let me get back on the mic here.
Oh, that sounds better, doesn't it? CBs were replaced by cell phones and computers and instant messaging and texting. In 2008, I can blog, send a message on Twitter, post a comment on a website. We've ditched the CB, but its ghost entered our iPhone and BlackBerry. We have many means of spraying this chatter to anyone who cares to catch it. Instead of Breaker 19 and What's Your 1020, we LOL or ROTFL. We don't have handles like Rubber Duck. We have usernames, which are never our real names. As our technology evolves, we've prioritized the ability to connect in this transitory and largely anonymous way. Multi-zillion dollar industry constructed around mostly shooting the breeze. Yeah, the spirit of the CB lives on. It's a CB with global range. That's great in a way, but I miss CBs. I miss the static and the distant fading signals and those mysterious truckers. Over. So one of our producers on the show, Angela Kim, is spending this weekend unpacking boxes. She recently moved into a new apartment. See, at her old place, Angela got robbed, which makes you feel utterly powerless, doesn't it? Someone has your stuff, and you can't even explain to them why it's worth more than money. But what if you could talk to the thief? Angela wrote this letter after her home was burglarized this summer.
Dear thief, you already know the first part of this story. On the evening of July 30th, I came home. I walked in, and it felt strange, but I didn't know why. Nothing seemed to be out of place, until I went to check my email. My laptop was gone. I looked beside it, and both of my backup hard drives were missing, too. I ran to the other rooms and looked at my bookshelf and saw that my recording equipment and my camera were missing as well. The police said that there were no signs of forced entry. I got a chill. I never lend my keys to anyone. How did you get in? My camera case was where I left it, but all the contents were missing. You took the time to put things back carefully and chose what you wanted to take. I didn't even sleep that night. I kept all the lights on and called my friend because you made me feel so alone and vulnerable. I was more scared than angry that evening. The next morning, I was going over a mental list of things you took from me. And suddenly I felt sick. And I thought, my pictures. In the last 6 years, I've amassed hundreds of photographs digitally. I saved my prized possessions in three places, my computer and my two backup hard drives. You took them all. I've started asking my friends if they have any photos to replace the ones I lost.
Well, I don't have any pictures because you take all of the pictures.
That's my friend Tao. She's been searching, but found something else in the process.
I realized you were the one who has been documenting our entire more than a decade friendship.
She's right. Within my circle of friends, I'm the photographer. Tao and I started to talk about our adventures, and she remembered the time that we were in London.
We must have looked like the most amused girls in the world. Like, we were taking pictures of us on a bus. We were, like, just so happy.
Yeah.
And then you went to Sweden, and you came back, and you showed me all your pictures.
Yeah, they're gone, too.
Yeah, they are gone.
But are they really gone? What did you do with them, exactly? For the last 2 months, I keep hoping the police will call me and say that they found my stuff. I even check Craigslist regularly, hoping you posted my things to sell. But as time goes by, the worst part isn't the missing electronics or the photos. It's how you've managed to insert yourself in my memories. My memories are changing because of what you did. Now when I reminisce, my emotions turn from nostalgia to anger and loss. You've attached yourself to my happy moments. There's this one picture I do have. I found it as an old email attachment that I sent out. It's a group picture from my friend Priya's wedding last year. It was the last time that my childhood friends and I were together. Julie flew in from the Philippines, Rajani came in from New York, and I remember Priya looked like a princess. Her magenta sari was covered with crystals that shimmered when the light hit it. I probably took over 100 pictures that day. But now, I just have this one. My friend Mike is trying to make me feel better.
When I was looking for pictures for you, it was great to just come across a few that I had. I think the pictures of like me, you, and Hope in college were like, oh, wow, we remember those times, you know? And like they're like memories that you don't think about like on an everyday basis, but if you just see one picture, you know, without any words or any description, you're like, oh, I remember that time.
That's nice for him, but the thing is, it won't ever be like that for me. The photos I get from friends will only be fragments from my past. It will be from their point of view, not mine. I could have posted my photos online or stored it on a server, but they're my photos. I didn't want strangers looking at them. But I guess I lost that privacy, thanks to you. Each day, I pray that I'll get my sense of security back and hope that I'll get my photos returned. But slowly, I've begun to lose that hope. I'm writing to you because I want my memories back. And if they're erased and you sold my stuff, I want to know why you did it. I wish I could say that what you did has made me a stronger person. But you know what? I'd be lying. I'm still dealing with putting together the remnants of my past, and I'm making sense of why this happened. I just hope one day that I can come to peace with what you did to me.
On our website, we posted that one photo of Angela at her friend's wedding. That's the only photo. It's at weekendamerica.org.
Is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Foster School of Business Executive MBA Program.
Look down at the sidewalk. No, no, not at the old gum or the leaves or the litter. At the poetry. And the memorials to the dead, coming up on Weekend America.
Thank you.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. The weekend used to be a bit of a breather, but these days the news keeps churning through Saturday and Sunday. The election, the financial crisis, there's always something new to pay attention to. Still, let's step back just a bit and look at what's important. We've been asking people from all walks of life to offer their thoughts on what voters should be thinking about this election season. Today, we meet Baltimore physician Hugh Hill. He works in the emergency department at the Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center. It's a busy place, and Dr. Hill is a busy guy, so we followed him through the hospital.
Within the past few months, one of the most dramatic stories was a stabbing that went through the front part of the heart and out the back. The knife went out the back. This is usually a fatal injury, as you'll understand. This man was scooped up quickly by the ambulance, brought to our emergency room. We very quickly got into the man's chest. The chief resident of surgery very quickly found both of the holes in the heart. One of our younger nurses was standing next to him, and he had her reach into the chest with a gloved hand and hold the heart up so that he could close the hole and then to squeeze the heart to get the blood flowing again with her hands. The man was taken up to the operating room within about an hour, and to our delight, and for some of us our surprise, he not only survived, but he survived, as we say, neurologically intact. He walked out of the hospital. That's the kind of thing that we want to be here for. But one of the big fears about emergency care being on the ropes is that we may not have high-quality services available for those kinds of cases where we can save somebody. Between the middle of the decade that we're in now and the middle of the last decade, there was an increase in emergency department visits of about 18%. At the same time, there was a huge cutback. There were like over 700 hospitals closed their doors in the United States, and 400 fewer emergency departments. So the system is pressured increasingly. As we walked from the emergency department to the offices where we are now, we were approached by a young man with a red eye who had been seen recently in the emergency department and was concerned that he still had a problem with his eye. He stopped us on the sidewalk, was, I would say, concerned to the point of being nearly agitated.
Something's in my eye. It's been like it's a Friday's. Can you look and tell?
I can't tell. You know what you need?
I mean, look how
if you're still having symptoms. Wait a minute, listen to me. If you're still having symptoms, you need an x-ray.
But he didn't give it to me.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Because they don't have insurance.
No.
Instead of pushing out the door.
That's no. Wrong. We don't do that. I know the guys that work in there. I'm one of them.
I want the fast
We
track.
Don't push anybody out the door because they don't have insurance.
But,
it's if we think you need something.
But from your experience, by looking in my eye, can you tell something's in there still?
What I would do if you're still having symptoms, I can't tell from looking what I'm telling you. Listen to me for a minute. I hear you. Listen to me. You need an x-ray.
He perceived that he had gotten less than optimal care in his mind because he didn't have insurance. And we don't do that. We absolutely do not do that. We don't want to turn anybody away, and by law, we cannot turn anybody away. We take care of everybody depending on how badly they're hurt and they're injured and how sick they are, regardless of their ability to pay. The problem comes afterwards when they get a huge bill from the hospital. What happens down the road? I fear that there will be places where we'll begin to look like a third world country. I've visited third world countries where I've seen stretchers out on the street outside an emergency department lined up with people lying on the stretchers waiting for care. And when our waiting rooms are full, people here even some days have to stand outside. When I was a young doctor, all of my colleagues were vehement in their opposition to national health insurance. The idea of having a system like the English did was roundly criticized. More and more physicians in the United States have come to the idea that a single-payer plan or a government-run system is better than the mess we have now. In my own specialty, emergency physicians, I think in surveys and polls, nearly two-thirds of them say they favor a single-payer plan. To me, that's an evidence of how bad the situation has got.
Emergency room physician Hugh Hill at the Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center in Baltimore.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe, coming to you from St. Paul, where we don't normally think of the sidewalk much. It's something to avoid slipping on in the winter months, maybe something to shovel the snow off of. Other than that, who cares about a sidewalk, right? But recently, something has changed. The sidewalks started filling up with poetry. For the past few months, when the city has had to pour fresh cement for a new sidewalk, there's been a poem on hand to stamp right into it. And today, St. Paul's public art community is gathering in a neighborhood with a lot of freshly poured poems to celebrate the project. Minnesota Public Radio's Chris Roberts has our story.
People in St. Paul now have to watch their step when they go for a walk. They may stumble across a poem. It happened to Patty Zerlo, who was on a stroll with her dog the other day.
I'm walking down the sidewalk looking down as you do in Minnesota.
Zerlo's making fun of how Minnesotans generally don't like to make eye contact on the street. Anyway, she's looking down.
And here I see Second Love.
Second Love turns out to be this little poem etched in the sidewalk.
He kissed the girl in the ballerina skirt. It was a long one, like the kiss, drenching her sneakers in tulle.
It was an exciting discovery for Zerlo, who immediately envisioned guerrilla poets with engraving tools stalking the neighborhoods of St. Paul. When told it was a city-sponsored installation, she felt a little let down.
I thought it was like people were finding out when the sidewalks were being replaced and then sneaking in the middle of the night and doing this, but now you're saying they're on the city payroll. It's a little less romantic now, but still very cool.
Actually, the project is being funded by a local public art group with the city's blessing. Marcus Young is St. Paul's artist in residence. Young, too, was walking down the sidewalk, head down in Minnesota fashion, when he began to notice how construction companies stamp their work.
And it'll say Knutson Construction or Standard Sidewalk. And one day I just thought, hey, that's an opportunity for art.
So Young invited residents to submit their verse, limited to 150 characters or less. The 20 winning poems are being stamped on fresh sidewalks throughout St. Paul.
I reach for a name, a song, a tune, and memories scatter.
Naomi Cohn is also looking down at the sidewalk. It contains her poem, Dementia. It's dedicated to her father, who struggled with his ability to think and remember as he got older.
Memories scatter, minnows fleeing a toothy pike. I catch a few laggards, but know these are nothing to the 100 fish that fled.
Cohn wrote this poem a while ago in a workshop. She knows it's sad, but she's happy it's being published in cement.
So I think it just puts it in a different place where it's free and open. You don't have to go to a reading or coffee shop or a library or a space that has a certain approach to it.
There's another sidewalk poem a few blocks away from Cohn's. It goes, a little less war, a little more peace. A little less poor, a little more eats. 10-year-old Dejan McDonough has passed over it many times, walking down his block.
I like it because it's true, and poor people do need to eat food and stuff.
Dejan thinks the sidewalk poems bring a lot to his neighborhood. He likes how some of them share wisdom or lay out a path to follow. He even protected one as it was drying.
When it was wet cement, my friend almost stepped on this, and I said, don't step on that because that's beautiful work that people worked on a lot.
That poetry stamping work will continue through October. Then there's the question of whether the poems can survive the freeze-thaw cycle of a Minnesota winter. But organizer Marcus Young says the project has already come up with a new way to look at sidewalks as blank pages.
And if you accept that the sidewalk panel is a blank page, then we have this amazing book in our city that is our city.
In St. Paul, I'm Chris Roberts for Weekend America.
Okay, so that's St. Paul. Now let's travel to Philadelphia, but please make sure you stay on the sidewalks. Girard Avenue crosses the entire city of Philadelphia, east to west, and often it's a dividing line. The rapidly gentrifying Center City neighborhoods pretty much stop at Girard. Reporter Jonathan Menjivar was at 28th Street in Girard recently, and he noticed something about the sidewalk.
I was feeding a meter, fumbling around for quarters, when something on the sidewalk caught my eye. There were all these names and dates written in what looked like whiteout. Each name had its own tiny cobblestone. A lot of them said RIP, and they look like little tombstones. Philly's a pretty rough town, and I always feel like I'm watching my back. But the memorial was literal, concrete evidence that this neighborhood was dangerous. But I was curious, so I went into the sneaker store right next to the memorial.
Hi. Good. My name is Jonathan, and I saw this memorial out here. Do you guys know about it?
Yeah, we did it.
We did it.
You did it?
We did it. For all the people that we knew from the hood.
John Lewis was working the afternoon shift at Young Sneaker City.
It's a lot of our friends that died.
Yeah? How did they?
In the street. Shot.
Most of them are my customers, and they died in a young age.
That's the store's owner, Young Lee. He made the memorial. To understand why, you need to know a little bit about him. Young was 15 when he came to Philly from Korea. And when he was in college, he started the store to help his family. It's been in the same spot for 23 years and kind of become a neighborhood hangout. Young got to know a lot of the guys around here, and some of his friends died young. One day, he printed out a scanned picture of one of them and put it right above the door of the store.
I started with one picture, and then people, you know, their family asked me to, can they put the pictures up there? So, you know, I say, okay, come on, bring it down here. I had more, but, you know, I ran out of space, you know, which is bad. You know, I don't want to see a lot of people die.
And then about 4 years ago, on a really hot summer day, the store was empty and Young had some time on his hands. And he was looking at his gallery and thinking about all these guys who'd spent time hanging out in the store. And he thought,
maybe people might, you know, remember those guys if I put it outside on the street.
So he went outside and started writing their names.
I think I used the exterior paint. Yeah, white paint.
White paint on cobblestones doesn't allow a lot of room for words of remembrance. Just dates and names, really. And a lot of the names are nicknames. Sweet Pea, a guy named Roller Robert Taylor, who Young tells me died of an overdose. And then there's One Arm Marky.
He only had one arm.
Right.
I mean, he was crazy. He used to, you know, ride motorcycle with one hand. And he do, what's you call that?
A wheelie?
Yeah. And he got into fight with this, you know, pretty big guy. With one arm, he knocked this guy out. Yeah.
Young smiles and leans his hand against the tree right next to the memorial. We're looking down at it. There are weeds growing between the cobblestones. And then this big guy walks up and shouts out to me, "That's a good man right there."
Like, if you're $20, $10 short and you're a good customer, he let you go. He got the newest, the latest, and the greatest stuff. He's a real good merchant, man. Yeah. I really respect this guy right here. Yeah.
Seems like he's more than just a shoe merchant, though. Like, seems.
I mean, he's a human being, first of all. And he understands. And I'm a black guy. And I got the ultimate respect for him like that. You see what I'm saying?
A lot of the men on the memorial, they are all men, by the way. They sound like they were kind of rough guys. But Young remembers all of them fondly. He points out another stone for someone named Julius Picard, who he tells me was a good friend and JBM member.
Junior Black Mafia is called. It's kind of vicious street gang.
So when you say he was a good friend, what do you mean?
I mean, you know, even though he might have a different life, I didn't, you know, look at him like he was a gangster or none of that.
Yeah. Why? I think most people would.
I don't know. I mean, maybe it's in my... I don't know. It's maybe...
Just who you are?
Yeah. Maybe that's why people still like me around here. I mean, this is kind of one of the worst areas in Philly. But I'm still alive.
Young was robbed at gunpoint once, but he says he feels safe here. He moved out to the suburbs years ago, but occasionally he'll still get a beer with guys from the neighborhood after work. Once he took a bunch of them down to the Jersey Shore for a deep-sea fishing trip. He chartered a boat and took all these guys who'd never left Philly out on the ocean.
They say, I'm down, like, they're people. You know, I'm like one of them.
Yeah.
You understand?
Yeah.
I've been here for so long, I mean, you know, I'm almost like a black, you know, even though I'm an Asian.
Young is in his 50s now, and he says that sometimes he thinks about retiring or trying something else. He's looked into selling the business a couple times, but most of the people he's talked to have been too afraid to work in this neighborhood.
Yeah, I'm pretty much stuck here.
Stuck, but also pretty much home. In Philadelphia, I'm Jonathan Menjivar for Weekend America.
This weekend, you can find Young Lee at Sneaker City, as usual. You can see some great photos of Young and his cobblestone memorial at our website. Also, photos of Sidewalk Poems in St. Paul and links to more about that project. It's all at weekendamerica.org. Here in Minnesota, besides reading our sidewalks, we're driving over the new 35W Bridge. Might not seem like big news, driving over a bridge, unless you know that the bridge replaced one that collapsed a little more than a year ago. Bridges in America are rusting. Roads are going unrepaired. And it's getting to be more and more of a problem. Weekend America is launching a special project, and we want your stories about how aging infrastructure is reshaping your life. What's gone unfixed in your town, and how has that affected the community that you live in and the people that you live there with? Let us know. Go to weekendamerica.org. Okay, breaking news here. Summer's over. It's true. Looking at the weather map, we got rain in the Northwest. Shocker. Freezing temperatures inching into the upper Midwest. Party's over, kids. But good times are still available. Here's Stephanie Curtis.
Sunny and 65 in Algona, Iowa. I better check that one more time. Yep, sunny and 65. Gotta get it right when you're in a part of the country called Tornado Alley. Of course, you can have fun, too, like at Algona's Tornado Alley Run and Walk. What decides whether you run or walk? Going out on a limb here and saying it's whether or not there's a tornado. Sun in 91 is itchy if you're covered in hair. Something to think about in Round Rock, Texas at the Hairy Man Festival. Legend tells of a hirsute hermit in the woods who hassles passersby. Festival features Hairiest Man Contest, Dunk Booth, and Cakewalk. Hopefully no hair in those cakes. You know, Round Rock, if the hairy man does a lot of over-the-top comedy, it might be Robin Williams. Wamego, Kansas holds a Wizard of Oz festival. It's the law. There has to be one somewhere in Kansas every weekend. But Wamego adds a 50-mile bike race. You're expecting a Wizard of Oz joke here, aren't you? Nope, not happening. Cloudy, 77 at the Yellow Brick Road Race. If you fall, Elton John will be there to give you a couple of vodka and tonics to get you on your feet again. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org with a little bit of weather everywhere. I'm Stephanie Curtis for Weekend America.
Looking for a connection between Czechoslovakia and bluegrass music? Here's one, the dobro. Find out what it is and meet a dobro master next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. And the American Public Transportation Association, committed to helping Americans save on gas and become energy independent at publictransportation.org.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. The Roots and Blues and Barbecue Festival is tonight in Columbia, Missouri. On the bill, ribs and dobro virtuoso Jerry Douglas. The dobro, in case you don't know, is a guitar outfitted with a large metal plate. You play it face up on your lap. And Jerry is the Jimi Hendrix, Les Paul, and Eric Clapton of the dobro. He's the king, and he has been for 30-odd years now, and he's still a young man. Jerry's played on more than 2,000 albums, if you can believe it, and he's won 12 Grammys. He took us through the history of this unusual instrument.
First of all, dobro guitar was invented by five Czechoslovakian brothers. And this gets really convoluted really fast. And just in short, dobro guitar is short for Dopera brothers. Their last name was Dopera. And so they shortened it to dobro, and it's sort of like Kleenex, you know, sort of a household name at this point. And they had this love of Hawaiian music, but they didn't think that the guitars that the Hawaiian music players were loud enough. So they created this metal concaved cone in the middle of the guitar with a really shiny cover plate on the outside that looks like a hubcap to make the guitar louder. It works just like a speaker in your home stereo. I mean, the sound goes down in, is reflected right back out really fast, and that's what makes it different than a regular guitar. So they invented them to be used as Hawaiian guitars, so you would be... that kind of a sound. Hula girls and everything. And it found its way into country music through predominantly a guy named Bashful Brother Oswald. And he got this job with Roy Acuff and started playing country music. And, you know, they played like... pretty simple way of playing. He played with his thumb and an index finger. And then the next evolutionary step was through a fellow named Josh Graves, Buck Graves, who played with Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs. I saw Josh Graves and Bashful Brother Oswald play in Youngstown, Ohio. But I was a little 10-year-old kid, and I saw them both play the same night, and it just put me over the top. I had to learn how to make that sound. So Josh Graves' playing was more like a banjo in a way, and also had a lot of blues influences. So he would play something like this. Really influenced me because I was waking up in the morning and listening to Flatt and Scruggs records, and then at night, you know, being so close to Cleveland, Ohio, I was listening to rock and roll stations on a little transistor radio at night to go to sleep. So I was hearing the Beatles and the Stones at night, hearing Flatt and Scruggs in the morning. So I was a little confused musically. But so I ended up adapting a lot of that into my own playing. This instrument's sort of unlimited. It's not really been tested, you know. It's just sort of been accepted, kind of, you know. So sort of took it upon myself at that point to get attention for the instrument and then learn how to play the music and sound like I was there all along, you know. Sort of, okay, maybe this is an instrument that can do a lot of other things. And a lot of other people started realizing that too. And that's what really solidified my argument, you know, that it is an instrument for all genres of music. Yeah, my baby got something I was a little kid and played guitar and mandolin and all those things, I sang. And as soon as I started playing dobro, I stopped singing. This freed me up from using language to get things across, because I'm actually singing, but it's coming through this instrument. It's just a conduit. It's something to get these emotions and all these ideas out through instead of singing it. This is my voice. This is what I talk with.
That was dobro virtuoso Jerry Douglas. That piece was brought to us from Nashville producer Kim Green. Well, some people listen to music to escape. Reed Stowe listens to bring himself back home. Reed sailed out of New York Harbor on April 23rd, 2007, and he hasn't touched land since. He's trying to reach 1,000 days at sea, beat the world record for endurance sailing.
Since I've been at sea, it seems like I reverted back to old classic rock and roll, like Wooden Ships by Crosby, Stills, and Nash. It reminds me of the innocence of my youth and being at home with my loving parents and family and those things that are so far from me right now.
We'll hear more from Reed on an upcoming show, but what would you listen to if you had that much time to kill, confined to a 70-foot schooner for almost 3 years? Go to weekendamerica.org and let us know. We're compiling the ultimate out-to-sea listener playlist. Well, that does it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. You can download a free podcast of the entire program at weekendamerica.org. Get out there and enjoy your weekend, will you? Bye now.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
It's like a candy store for mad scientists. Hi, I'm John Moe. On the next Weekend America, we take you to Hollywood's shop for sci-fi props and laboratory equipment.
When they want weird, they come to me. I know that's what I have. It's weird.
A place so scary, you won't want to open your eyes. But you don't have to, because it's radio. Join us.